Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Andrade, Zico, and Nunes is onside. Nunes, still Nunes, goal! Zico for Nunes, the 1-2 that provided the first goal. Devastating finish, 3-0 to Flamengo. Again, that little nudge from Zico. The referee looked for an offside flag, it wasn't there.
Hello and welcome to the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and today we're back with another episode of the My Side series. Too often, football is seen as tribalistic, as fans display blinkered obsession for their football team, make outlandish claims via terrorist chants that their team is by far the greatest team the world has ever seen. However, within these claims of blind faith and devout following lies eras and teams which crystallise why supporters love their team or are prepared to suffer the recurring heartache. On even rarer occasions, you find a fan of football who can see the beauty and excellence in a side who lies beyond the confines of their own club's history. My Side is an in-depth discussion with a different guest each episode about a side that made an eternal impression upon them, either a club side over a single season or an international side at a major championships, discussing the key protagonists, the major incidents, the legacy and much more. My Side is the personal story of a love affair between a football fan and a side that defines their love of the beautiful game. And I'm delighted to say that my co-host for this series, as always, is my good friend and kindred spirit, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Oh, very well indeed. Apart from, you know, a bit of a power cut in the last 24 hours that did put this in jeopardy up until about 2 hours ago.
Oof.
I was on the brink of dropping that in about 2 hours ago, but no, we have powered again and we're up and running. But all good, yes. I'm looking forward to this one. This is going to be outstanding tonight.
That's excellent. Yeah. As we've been chatting in the sort of build up to this, the three of us, again, like you say, this is right. Again, as I think we just seem to be very selective in either what we choose, who we choose, or who we seem to attract to these podcasts. But they always seem to pretty much land right in the sweet spot of where you and I are interested.
Yeah, and I think they know, kind of like, you know, I think they must be well drilled now. I think you know what these two are really like is this one, and they're exactly right.
So. Today's guest making their debut appearance on the Lob podcast, which I'm really delighted to say, and it's come about really from a shared appreciation of the beautiful game and some absolutely fascinating discussions through social media. And I'm delighted to say, well, two things: one, the team they've chosen, and obviously the guest that we've got. But I'm delighted to say that tonight we're going to be talking about the 1980-81 Flamengo side. And tonight's guest is Luciano Nunes, who we're going to call Lou because my Brazilian accent is awful and I fear I will butcher his name all night. Lou, welcome. Oh, welcome good. To the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be a part of this and looking really forward. I've been looking forward to doing this for a while now. And yeah, it's going to be fantastic.
So obviously, like I say, when Steve and I came up with the idea of this series, and you know, people got back to us with sort of the usual suspects of sides. We've had a couple of Liverpool sides, we've had the Invincibles, we've had the Manchester United treble side, we've had one of Pep Guardiola's side, and then yours arrived from sort of Brazilian football, from a bygone era, if you like. for a lot of the listeners and a lot of the people who work at these football times, it's only Steve and I and Gary and Paul who remember these sorts of sides. And then when yours landed, it was like, yes, we are all over this one. We are definitely having this as an episode, without a shadow of a doubt. So it was your, you were always going to be on. Don't worry about that. As soon as it landed, you were always going to be on.
Beautiful.
I'll tell you what I am interested in, though, before we start. I suppose, you know, especially as you're new to the podcast and obviously new to the listeners as well, and that's, I suppose, a little bit about yourself, your background, your love of football and where that comes from.
Yeah, so I was born in Brazil, in Rio, and in our family, on both sides, my father's side and my mother's side, were diehard Flamengo supporters. We bleed red and black. And I had no choice, you know, in the matter. And I became a Flamengo supporter by birth, I would say. A lot like, I would say a lot of people, you know, in a rich footballing country, that's how it tends to work. The funny thing is, my dad's not really much of a football fan, at least when it comes to club support. He's not really affiliated with any clubs. So this love really came from my mom. And then on his side of the family, like his sisters and my grandma, right? They're incredibly passionate about it. And so that's how I got my love for the club. For football in general, just playing as a kid. You know, I'm sure we all wanted to be a professional at one point. Just never worked that way. We ended up moving here to the United States, but the love never died. And so here we are.
It's funny listening to you speak. And I suppose, you know, like you say, you talk about, you know, sort of about not family divisions, but almost sometimes it's a birthright. Sometimes it's almost seems to pass through genetics and DNA. And obviously Rio is a massive city. You know, with, you know, maybe it wasn't just Flamengo. It just, like you say, it just, they were just their colours, that black and red was what you almost inherited. And Stephen, I suppose, you know, coming from Liverpool, I guess you can fully relate to that.
Oh, definitely. You know, family ties, and it's that, it's in the impressionableness of youth as well, isn't it? It's those first formative, you know, experiences of football and what it all means for a team like Flamengo. You know, it's similar in the way it is for Liverpool. My initial memories of football revolve around great celebration and vivid, very vivid kind of, you know, images of a flash of silver and, you know, and the colour of red. And it's like I say, it's for me, Liverpool red. And here we are with the red and the black of Flamengo. And it does, it just stands out. And it's the colour of the kit on the greenness of the pitch. And it's absolutely everything. And those are the memories that just stick in the mind and hook you very early on.
I suppose, you know, Lou, like you say, a lot of it comes from family and, you know, from fathers or mothers or aunts, uncles, grandparents, you know, whatever it is. But in terms of, I suppose, of your sort of, you know, before we get onto this side that we're going to talk about, I mean, my earliest memories of the game are, like, as people know, you know, from the H2 World Cup and a little bit before that. So, you know, sort of my earliest memories are probably, you know, I'm not saying you would love to have them, but, you know, you can probably relate to the sides that form my earliest memories. But we're interested in what your sort of earliest memories, I suppose, are of Brazilian football.
Yeah. So in Rio, and I don't know how that was in England back then, but I would say within the late 80s, early 90s, the television, the broadcasters wouldn't really show the games, the local games, live on TV. So you had to listen to on the radio if you didn't go to the stadium. And a lot of my memory early on were of listening to the radio with friends. And when the games weren't local, we were watching it on TV. But there were very faint, you know, it's that weird fog of childhood, right? So you get these little glimpses here and there. So the first real clear memory that I have is of them winning the 92 Brazilian championship. And then back then, they were led by a veteran junior at that time, the great left back for Brazil in the 82 and 86 World Cups. And in 92, he was playing as a midfield maestro. And that's actually what they call him in Brazil, the maestro. Such was his class in on a pitch. And he had switched to that position back when he transferred to Torino from Flamengo in the early 80s. So when he got older, obviously, the legs couldn't, you know, take him up and down the pitch on the flanks. So midfield it was. And that side was great. Besides him, other players that were part of that team were goalkeeper Gilmar and midfielder Zinho, who both won the World Cup with Brazil in 94. There was a guy, his name is Paulo Nunes, who was part of the Brazil's Copa America winning side of 97. Djalminha, who I'm sure you guys know, he was also breaking out on that team back then. And there's one guy that a lot of people outside of Brazil don't know about, but his name is Marcelinho Carioca. And this guy was an absurd free kick taker. Just so you have an idea, when there's a video on YouTube titled Top 30, and it's only referring to the top 30 free kicks from this one guy, that should say something about how good he was at taking free kicks. And I think in total, he ended up scoring about 60 free kicks in his career. So, you know, these guys were playing on that team, and that's who I really have a really good recollection of.
I mean, I suppose, like we say, Stephen, you know, video, you know, we often have YouTube video klaxon alerts, and clearly there's another one right there. You've got to love the Brazilian, you know, the Brazilian football videos. And, you know, if there's one that's just literally top 30 free kicks from the same player, I think it deserves the YouTube klaxon. But before we introduce this side, I suppose, you know, again, Stephen, we talk about teams and, you know, birthright and DNA and hereditary and passed on and blah, blah. But sometimes it's the players, isn't it? I mean, obviously for myself, I can't relate to how you and Lou do with regards to the passing on of teams and supporting clubs. I went very rogue and very independent early on. And for me, it was just all about the players. But sometimes the side that you are drawn to can purely literally be chance with the fact or the collection of players who happen to be playing when you're sort of finding the game at an early age.
Oh, completely. You know, the realm of luck, you know, it's being in the right place at the right time, the right team at the right time. And yeah, you know, I think from my perspective, I feel blessed with that. I think if you're the supporter of a team like that has that rich tapestry of success, and, you know, those brilliant players that just take the breath away, then, you know, if you don't appreciate it, or you don't kind of like, if you can't just sit there and say, oh God, how lucky am I to watch these players, then, you know, maybe partially you don't deserve them. You know, for me, I'm lucky enough is that, yes, I'm a passionate Liverpool supporter, but, you know, there's that other side of me that's just a, you know, football fan in general, a football lover in general. So, you know, I have that, you know, two sides of that coin. And I think my own appreciation of my own team and the players that I've been lucky enough to watch and the successes of the team, you know, it makes me appreciate the players and teams and successes of others, you know, as well. And, you know, it comes down to kind of like a sense of education in football. And I think that's something as a Liverpool fan of a certain era and a certain grounding and a certain leadership almost. And because not me as a leader, but being led and taught by the, you know, my dad and other people that showed the football that they loved, you know, it's contagious, you know, and yes, it's hereditary, but football can be contagious. You don't have to have that hereditary link as such, or to be led by someone to it. You know, you can just be caught by it and drawn in. You know, so it's a multifaceted thing.
It is, you know, it absolutely is. And I suppose, you know, Lou, obviously, the reason why I've got you on, you know, you've come on tonight is to talk about this Flamengo side. So you've now got as long as you want to sort of introduce this side and really, you know, this season and why you want to talk about them and why they are your side.
Great. So this side, obviously, I was born in 83, so I didn't actually get to see them play live, right? But the thing is, whenever I would start going on about, you know, this or this player or that player or that team that's doing really well, my dad would pull me aside. And, you know, this is coming from a guy who wasn't really a football fan, but he appreciated good football, right? So there's that distinction. He would always pull me aside and say, look, yeah, these guys are great, right? But there's Garrincha, there's Pelé, there's Brazil's 1970, 1982, and Zico's Flamengo. Those guys knew how to play, right? And it would always plant the seed in the back of my mind early on. And back then, it was, you know, you didn't have the benefit of YouTube or even, you know, tapes were hard to come by. But I grew up with these guys in the back of my brain, sort of as on a pedestal. So when I became old enough, I was able to really get a hold of all, you know, the matches and really get to know the players and really get to know how that team played. And I just fell in love. And I understood why. There was this level of appreciation coming from, you know, a guy who doesn't even really follow the game that closely, but unless it's so good that he can't not watch, if that makes sense. So, you know, as a kid, your perspective is limited, but later on you start to realize that there are good teams, there are great teams, and then there are transcendental teams and teams that capture people's imaginations, not just their own fans, but other people's imaginations. And as you can probably tell, to fit into that criteria, playing style is one of the driving factors. And this side was one of those teams, especially in Brazil, where, unfortunately, club loyalties or people just being disingenuous, and again, and due to club loyalty, it blinds them to recognize, you know, from recognizing the greatness of the club's achievements. But this Flamengo side sort of came out of it broke through that, and I think that says a lot. Just so you know, this team is known in Brazil as the greatest club side after the Santos of Pelé. So that's obviously a huge deal.
That's it right there, isn't it, Stephen? That's why we do this. When you listen to that, it doesn't matter who we have on the episode. Doesn't matter what team they've picked. That's it right there, isn't it? That's the common denominator there.
It's that passion. It's that, you know, octave or two higher in the voice, and it's the dropping away of the ears and the. And you know, the childhood coming through, you know, and you can't help but, you know, lock into it and just be totally in awe of that passion, and it's brilliant.
It's, straight away, Lou, I think, you know, anybody who's listening now is going to be, like I say, hopefully he's going to start looking at this team now. Obviously, as we get a bit later on, and I'm sure a lot of Liverpool supporters will already know of this team. For a major reason. Obviously, before we sort of go on to the season and the team, etc., that sort of thing. I suppose I'm interested because a lot of this, you know, we've talked about, you know, teams and having great players and being entertaining, but sometimes, occasionally, managers get overlooked, or the person who orchestrates the way these teams perform. So I suppose before we introduce the 11, I'm just kind of interested in Claudio Coutinho, who was, you know, the manager of this side, who was responsible, I suppose, for producing this transcendental, I think you described it as, which is a great word, by the way, you know, this transcendental side. So, you know, if you can just give us a little bit of background on his impact, if you like, on, you know, the type of manager he was and the impact that he had on this side.
Absolutely. So he took over in 1976, and Claudio Coutinho was a very smart guy. He connected with the players on a human level, but he was also known to be very strict, a stern type of guy, and wasn't afraid to yell at them. After all, he was a captain in the military, so he had that strict, stern style about him. His background in physical education was massive to his side's conditioning. So just so we have an idea, he took concepts from Kenneth Cooper, who was the man who prepared NASA's astronauts to go to the moon. He was actually personally invited by Cooper to be part of the training of the NASA astronauts. And he took that experience and brought it over with him to Brazil. He was actually one of the trainers for the 1970 Brazil World Cup winning team. And as we all know, they played in Mexico, and in Mexico City at elevation, that his drills and his training philosophy and what he brought from Cooper's method was crucial in the team's performance up at elevation, right? Apart from that, he wanted to play a more modern European-based style, which was heavily frowned upon in Brazil at the time. He admired and borrowed a lot of concepts from Rinus Michels' Total Football, as well as having his own interpretation of the game, and he pushed certain concepts like overlapping and polyvalence or versatility. He even came up with a term, I think he came up with it, which was called future point for, you know, when he was describing where the ball was going to be, he wanted the players to be positioned in a certain way and things like that. He was very different in Brazil. And because he was bringing this sort of European style, he caught a lot of flack for it, but he had enormous promise. And like an example, he liked his fullbacks playing through the middle or as wingers, depending on the situation. He would push for possession percentage in the opponent's final third, which we tend to associate these things with, you know, Pep Guardiola, for example, these days. But this guy was doing this back in the late 70s, early 80s, right? And all these ideas and his concept made this team very offensive, possession-based, well-conditioned, and with the type of players at their disposal, it was certainly a joy to watch.
Stephen, we sort of come back to these things, don't we? You know, talented players, and obviously the sides that we look at, you know, are filled with talented players. And sometimes I think, and, you know, maybe this is my fault with the way I've structured it, but maybe sometimes we don't give enough credit to the managers sometimes on these particular episodes.
Yeah, we probably don't. I think the great thing about the coaches, though, is and the managers is, yes, we should pay a bit more homage, but you find that teams, you know, aren't just moulded by a coach, but they take on, you know, the greatest teams take on kind of like the temperament of the coach. You know, it floods all the way through the club to the point that, you know, almost the supporters of the club will take on the, you know, the personality of the coach almost in the way that they support the team. You know, I've seen like whole sets of supporters morph into, you know, the personality of the coach. Liverpool are currently doing it. You know, everyone's Jurgen Klopp as far as, you know, there's 58,000 Jurgen Klopps in Anfield every other weekend. You know, and Claudio Coutinho is one of these. He ticks every box here, and, you know, he's massively underappreciated. And the fact that, you know, he helped remodel the Brazilian national team after the 1974 World Cup. You know, he wasn't in the immediate immediate successor to Zagallo. But, you know, that rehabilitation from that, you know, awful side of 74 that was the most un-Brazilian Brazilian national team at World Cup ever, perhaps.
Yes.
We all pay homage to Telly Santana for 82, but, you know, Santana wouldn't be able to do what he did in 82 without Coutinho having come before him. And also there's that tragic element of Coutinho as well. You know, he died so young and so tragically. And yes, he, you know, wasn't there at the business end when they come to the fruition of what this Flamengo side did. But, you know, he laid the groundwork for it. And, you know, he deserves so much credit for it.
That's brilliant. Brilliant. See, this is why you co-host, Stephen, because you just the brains of the outfit. So obviously, Lou, before we start getting into the season, into these 11 players, Flamengo leading up to this season, then I suppose a little bit of context of where they were. You know, you talk about how they're probably ranked as second best after Pelé Santos, in terms of league, you know, in terms of club size in Brazilian football. But leading up to this, you know, this early 1980s, you know, where were they sitting at with regards to levels of success at this particular point?
So Flamengo was a big club already by 1980, right?
Yeah.
But they had never won any titles or trophies on a national or international scale. They'd won many state titles, which were really significant in their own right. And just for a little bit of context here, in the early days of football, in a country so vast, traveling to meet other teams would be more like mounting expeditions. So it wasn't a regular thing until transportation became more advanced. So for a long time, clubs in Brazil played within their regions, and for the most part, that helped create these areas rich with their own footballing traditions and many local rivalries, which in turn contributed to the importance of these state championships. So from an outsider perspective, you see, you know, if Brazilian people speak of, you know, my club has won this state title or this state title, trust me, it's a big deal because it's such a big country and there are so many teams spread throughout that the local regional competitions are pretty stiff. It's changing a little bit these days, obviously, but back in those days, it was still a huge deal, right? So that importance carried over the years and even when full-on national competition started. But Flamengo hadn't done it on a national scale, and rivals started calling them or referring to them as a regional team. By the late 70s, 79 to be exact, they started making noise when they managed to win three back-to-back state championships. In 1980, they won the club's first Brazilian league title. And back then, it was still decided in the playoff format, and they met this monster side in Atlético Mineiro, with the likes of Luizinho, Cerezo, Palinha, Eder, and the great, great goal scorer, Reinaldo. And that final was known as the greatest final in Brazilian championship history. The first leg was won by Atlético Mineiro by 1-0 at the Mineirão Stadium. Then the second leg at the Maracanã in front of 150,000 was a pretty tense one, which saw Flamengo go up 1-0 within 7 minutes with a goal by Nunes. Then the stadium just exploded, but Atlético hit them right back just a minute later with Reinaldo. Then Zico put Flamengo in front, and just a minute before halftime. In the second half, Atlético's Reinaldo had pulled a muscle, and he needed to come off, but they had already made two subs, and so he kind of chose to stay on and hobbled on for a little bit, and something even crazier happened, which was after a lovely play between Cerezo, Palinha, and Eder, Reinaldo somehow managed to get his injured leg on it and scored the equalizer again for them. So then he finally goes down asking for a sub. The ref decided he was time-wasting and sent him off, which was really controversial. And it, you know, it was, in my opinion, it was unjust. It put a dent in the spectacle. And, you know, Flamengo is now up an extra player, but, you know, it's not their fault. And Nunes didn't care. So he took full advantage and scored Flamengo's third in the 37th minute. And this already feisty affair went up another level. And Chicão and Palhinha of Atlético Mineiro were sent off as well. But, you know, the winning side doesn't care, right? And that 3-2 was enough to guarantee Flamengo that championship. So then after that, you know, they went from 80 to 92. They would have won 5 league titles, 1 Libertadores Cup, 1 Intercontinental Cup, and not to mention even more state titles.
It's fascinating. Well, it is to me anyway, Steve. When you sort of listen to these names playing, you know, like Zico, Adair, Junior, you know, all the, but listening to them related into a club context is quite, it's quite surreal almost, isn't it? You forget that they actually had a life and a career outside of international football.
Yeah, you do, because that was it. You know, for us, we just kind of like saw them in Brazil shirts and these mysterious club names would be next to them in kind of like squad lists or within the Panini sticker book. You know, you get the sticker and then there'd be a little box where it would give you very limited information about these players. But there would be kind of like these names. And for me, they always stuck kind of like massively in the mind, these iconic names of South American teams that, you know, still to this day are, you know, a partial mystery. But, it is, you know, a very much a culture shock when you came to see them within a club context, within the, you know, the greatest glory eventually in Tokyo.
I suppose, again, as per usual, we're doing really well here now, Steve. We've got this nailed down. So we're at exactly half an hour, Lou. Wonderful context, wonderful passion about this side. A little bit of history leading up to this season. A bit about the manager, but now it's all about the 11, or certainly the principal 11 of this side that you've chosen now. People have done this in lots of different ways. You can do it however you want. But if you just want to sort of talk us through player by player, the main, you know, the main sort of 1 to 11, if you like, of this Flamengo side.
Okay. So the side that people have, I suppose, memorized in their heads are the guys that actually went to Tokyo, right? So we start the first 11, beginning with the goalkeeper, Raul, who was great in his own right. Leandro, the right back, just amazingly gifted player, as you probably know, Stu, from the 82 side. Funny enough, a lot of people consider him the best right back in Brazil after Carlos Alberto Torres. It's kind of an odd thing. There could be a nostalgia or club loyalty playing a part here, because, you know, there were other Brazilian right backs that you could throw in a mix there, but that tells you the magnitude of his impact, right, in Brazilian football. Then Marinho and Moser were the two center backs. Moser, who went to Benfica, also, he was supposed to be part of the national team, but he got injured in 82 and never went. But great, great, classy center back. And then we have Junior playing left back. Again, probably shouldn't need to introduce Junior, but for those who may not know, amazing ability on the ball, great vision, just such a classy left back who could play in the middle too. And then the two guys, I think, who are really underrated, Andrade and Adílio, who formed the midfield with Zico. These two guys were just excellent all around on the ball. Andrade, who played a little bit more of a holding midfielder. I feel he could have been part of the 82 side and would have brought a little bit more cohesion, you know, since he could link up with Junior on the left, Leandro on the right, and Zico up top. who knows, a little bit more familiarity might have prevented a certain catastrophe from happening. If you'd like to imagine how he plays, I would sort of compare him to Busquets a little bit, just in playing style. He just sits in that pocket, distributes the ball to the other guys. Giroud was a little bit more advanced, great skill on the ball, great passing range. Zico, I shouldn't need to really tell people about. If you don't know, shame on you. You should look him up. And we had Chita and Lico as the wingers. Chita coming in from the right, Lico on the left. Chita was actually very skillful, young player. He wanted to play in that number 10 role, but, I mean, Zico is on the team. You just have to find your find another role for yourself. And that's what happened. And Nunes up top was the striker, great goal scorer. Also shares a last name with me, but no relation, unfortunately. But, Claudio Coutinho was, as we spoke before, he was the manager. The whole philosophy of the side was his. Unfortunately, he died really right before the final in Tokyo. And Paulo Cesar Carpegiani was the one who took over the role of manager during that season, really. And he was actually a player before. He had played with, you know, since the late 70s up until 81 when he retired. It was, you know, due to a bad knee injury. And actually, it was in a friendly against Maradona's Boca Juniors, of all teams. And unfortunately, he had to retire after that injury. But that 11 is the one that sticks in people's minds. But, you know, there were a little bit of changes in the previous years, but this is the main 11 that people run with and are more familiar with, yeah, if you will.
Uh-huh. Brilliant. I look, again, love listening to it. Stephen, obviously, you know, we've mentioned earlier, like you said, you made a great point about little biographies in Panini stickers, and we see them arrive fully formed in their international jerseys. But, you know, you have to wonder how many great players that Europeans have missed out on seeing before the advent of YouTube and social media, you know, either through misfortune or injury or not hitting form at the right time in a World Cup cycle. You know, there must have been some wonderful, wonderful Brazilian footballers that we've never even seen.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this Flamengo side that played the Intercontinental Cup final, you know, of the 11, 9 of them were internationals. Only 3 of them went to the 82 World Cup, which, you know, we kind of closely associate this Flamengo side with. But yeah, no, 9 of them were internationals or would be internationals throughout the career. 2 of them would play at the 1990 World Cup. You know, so that longevity, you know, was amazing as well for some of the, you know, young players. But they still translated to players of massive substance a decade later. And yeah, there's so many there that, you know, could have slotted into that 82 side. And yeah, I fully agree with that. But yeah, I mean, you'll have to look at that 82 World Cup squad. Is that, you know, 20 of the 22 were playing their football in Brazil. At the time, there was only 2 playing in Europe. And, you know, that was an 82 squad that probably could have been picked 3 times over.
you've gone through the players there, Lou Forrest. And I suppose, again, a little bit, which is perhaps my own naivety, I guess, and I apologise for that. But in terms of formation, you know, in Brazilian club football at that time, was it a formation that would match up evenly against sort of England's preferred sort of 4-4-2, if you like, or was it different then?
Yeah, so looking back, so if we go by Jonathan Wilson's words in inverting the pyramid, right? The way he saw this team was a super offensive 4-5-1. Now, Lico and Chita were, before joining this team, midfielders, right? Like I said, Chita wanted to play the number 10.
Yeah.
And for obvious reasons, that didn't happen. But they were placed out wide. And given that the Coutinho's philosophy was for players to exchange positions, you would often find the wingers tucking into the midfield area, giving the idea that there were five players in that sector. Now, in Brazil, it's held that they played a 4-3-3 with one holding midfielder, one box-to-box midfielder, and one attacking midfielder in Zico. So that's how we usually tend to look at as a 4-3-3, which, again, it would make sense based on Coutinho's fondness for Rinus Michels, right? That 4-3-3 makes more sense, based on how we've seen that lineage coming along, right? Barcelona's and Ajax and so on. I would say they were a 4-3-3 side.
Okay, that's fair. That makes sense. I can work with that. I can relate to that. That's no problem. with regards to, I suppose the great moments, or we've talked about that. You've talked about the player, you've talked about the manager, you've talked a little bit about the history, and I suppose the family influence upon you and supporting this side. But I suppose we need to get to, the games, the moments, the big events that surrounded this side, and because a lot of this is bound up in success, and you mentioned earlier being state champions, but then going on to cast a wider net, if you like, in terms of capturing silverware. So, in terms of their success, or the success of this side, the tangible success of this side, where were the key moments for this team?
Yeah, like I mentioned before, that Atlético Mineiro side was a super impressive team in its own right, with great players. And besides the 1980 final, which was controversial, these two sides met again in the Libertadores Cup. And again, it was one of those where, so Flamengo got drawn into the same group as them, as Atlético Mineiro, right? After another two battles that ended at 2-2, Flamengo tied home and away against Olimpia and defeated Cerro Porteño twice. Flamengo and Atlético Mineiro ended up at the top of the group with 8 points each. That meant that they had to play yet another match as a tiebreaker. Now, this time it was a neutral ground in the state of Goiás in Brazil at the Serra Dourada Stadium. Now, for whatever reason, they decided to do this pitch design that was incredibly disturbing from a visual perspective. You can pull up videos on YouTube and you just be puzzled as to what was going on the pitch. It was so distracting. But apart from that, again, the referee decided to outdo the pitch design by ruining a classic match with what I would say the worst refereeing I've ever seen. The match never even went past the 35th minute. He red-carded Reinaldo for it was a pretty horrible sliding tackle from behind, which the red card is fair, but you could tell the ref was visibly way more agitated than the players. And then he proceeded to send off four more Atlético Mineiro players, and which meant that Flamengo was through. The game had just had to be forfeited, and it was unfortunate. But these battles with this Atlético team and teams like Grêmio and Internacional in Brazil with Falcão, they set this team up on course for being successful. That odd format of the Libertadores Cup saw another group after that with three teams in two groups. Flamengo played against Deportivo Cali from Colombia and George Wilstermann from Bolivia, and won all four matches, right? And then the final, obviously, was against this powerful team in Cobreloa, which beat Uruguayan powerhouses Nacional and Peñarol. But the thing with this Cobreloa team, they weren't really known at the time. They were a brand new club, but they had the backing of the Chilean state to form this great team in like 4 years, and they were already at the Libertadores final. So playing against that team, even though they weren't well-known, they clearly deserved to be there based on their performances and how they had been, let's say, helped by Pinochet's regime. And so the first leg at the Maracanã saw Flamengo win with 2 goals from Zico against 1 by Mereio from Cobreloa. And things, you know, seemed like they were going as expected. Like I said, this was kind of an unknown club, but people were really confident, let's just say, that Flamengo was going to win this. But for whatever reason, they were under, Cobreloa was under tremendous pressure. And we can point that at the looming shadow of Pinochet, you know, upon them. But the second leg was very hostile and very violent, as they were trying to pull all sorts of, you know, shenanigans during the match. I mean, Junior, when talking about the this meeting in Chile, he was one of their players, a guy called Mario Soto. He apparently went into the pitch holding like some sort of sharp object, and he ended up cutting Agilio's ear, and Agilio had to come off the game. And it turns out that it maybe was a rock or maybe a razor blade that this guy was carrying the entire match, which is insane. And then even the pitch side photographers were really hostile towards the Flamengo players. Junior says that once, you know, he tried to you know, maybe kind of reproach one of those pitch side photographers, and then when he stepped up, suddenly the guard that was standing next to the photographer just cocked his machine gun and, you know, yeah, put a halt to whatever Junior was going to do. So that's never nice. But so, you know, in the match, they managed to Cobreloa managed to get away with a 1-0 win. So then in the third leg, which was at neutral ground at the Estadio Centenario in Montevideo, Flamengo decided that they were there to play football no matter what, with a little caveat. But the end of the match was a relatively easy 2-0, right? Both goals scored by Zico, with the second one being just a simply gorgeous free kick, as he was known for. But the caveat was that there was a little payback from Flamengo. After the 2 goals had been scored, towards the end of the match, the coach Carpegiani, he took Nunes off and sent Anselmo in with one job only. And that was to give Mario Soto a taste of his own medicine. So Anselmo did just that. He went in, immediately punched Mario Soto. Mayhem started. You know, both of the players were sent off. And, you know, obviously we never condone that type of behavior in the slightest, right? But there's also got to be a little good feeling in that moment, I guess, right? But it's unfortunate that it happened. But, that shows a side of this team, too, that, you know, despite playing this beautiful game and being classy on a ball, they were not going to just take it, you know, laying down. They were going to give it some back to give it back to you too. If if a team tried to rough them up.
It's funny, isn't it, Stephen? But again, you know, I think every great team just has that little bit of steel that runs through all the silk, if you like. You always need just that little bit of edge to be really successful.
Yeah, you've got to have the fighters in there as well. You know, it's the truly great teams have that element of silk and steel. You know, there's the, you know, the bludgeoning side of it, the side that can stand up to a fight. You know, you've got to be able to beat, you know, the agricultural teams as well as the artisans. You know, you've got to be able to have an answer to absolutely everything that's thrown at you to be one of the greats, and yeah, this you know, these brilliant stories kind of like illuminate just how much you know, Flamengo had that going for them as well.
I mean, obviously, we're gonna. You know, I want to ask Lou about Intercontinental Cup game against Liverpool, and you know, and what the impact of that was on Brazilian football. But before I come back to Lou, Stephen, you know, as a Liverpool fan, you know, your perspective, I suppose, of the side that we're talking about tonight. I mean, obviously, Liverpool had a front row seat to this side.
Oh, totally in awe of them. You know, this is, as a Liverpool fan, you know, if you're allowed a favourite defeat, then this is it for me. You know, this was Zico, you know, after all. And I'd been enthralled with Zico since, you know, Brazil had gone to Wembley in May 81. This marvellous kind of like end of season friendly. And it was before, you know, it would be about a fortnight before Liverpool played the European Cup final against Real Madrid. And it was played on a Tuesday night. I always remember Ray Clements being the captain for it. And it was two nights before the FA Cup final replay, that iconic 3-2 where Villa scores the winner. This game had just been played, and Zico scored this wonderful, wonderful goal. And he just stuck in my mind from that moment onwards. So, you know, when it came that Liverpool were playing Flamengo in this game, It was just a brilliant education to watch it, and I was just totally enthralled. And you know, ever since then, they've always been kind of like the South American team that I've always wanted to see back at that pivotal game again. And luckily enough, we have just seen that.
It has come full circle this year. You're absolutely right.
It has completely. Totally in awe of this side.
And you're right. You know, sometimes there are just names of clubs that you just want to see back where you think they belong.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in kind of like that essence of the teams that were doing well during your formative years of kind of like being absorbed and consumed by football, that you do want them to prosper and to come back. You know, if they've fallen away, you know, you will them to come back and live again, basically.
So in Brazil, Lou, obviously, you know, when Flamengo go to this Intercontinental Cup in Tokyo, you know, the defeat Liverpool, European champions, you know, What was the impact from a Brazilian perspective on that Flamengo side? I suppose across South America, yes, it was a Brazilian side, it was a Rio side, but in terms of South American football, how was that victory perceived?
It was massive, right? Because in South America, you know, you play against each other and you play against your fellow countrymen. But there's that divide, right, across the ocean. And you're hearing about the feats of these European teams. But what you really want to see is, okay, how do we stack up against these guys, right? We're watching these great players across the pond, but we get a chance to do that in the World Cups, but we also want to see our own clubs go up against these clubs we all hear about. And, you know, even more so, I guess, lately, which, you know, because these clubs are also taking our players. Our players are playing abroad, right? So we want to see how we do against them. And so whenever there's a win, it's a huge, huge... Actually, whenever there's a match, period, you know, between these two continents, it's a huge deal. If you look at the way these past few Brazilian teams have come up against European competition, it's always, you know, everybody behind the ball, defend the entire match. They hope for this one counterattack and that will save them and get this 1-0 victory and call it a win. When in fact they hadn't been playing like that until that point, they just changed their whole strategy just to play the final. I personally don't like that. So this Flamengo team took it to that great Liverpool side in their own style. They played their game and then they showed what they were capable of, right? Even this last, you know, match, Liverpool and Flamengo this last year when they played, okay, Flamengo lost, but at least they didn't sit back and defend the entire match. We'd much rather play your style and maybe not win, come away with a lose, but you know, you can be proud of the performance that you put in. But back then, when you look at the at that time period, just the it was like 36 days, right, where Flamengo defeated Botafogo by 6-0. There was, you know, it was kind of a revenge match for Botafogo win by the same scoreline in 75. Then they won the state championship against Vasco da Gama. They won the Libertadores Cup. And between the Libertadores and the Tokyo final, that's when Coutinho was back in Brazil. He wasn't coaching the team at that time, but he was actually coaching the LA Aztecs in the North American League. But he had gone back to Brazil on a break. He was at the beach playing volleyball with Junior because, you know, they were friends. And a friend came up to Coutinho, invited him to go fishing. Coutinho was an avid spear fisherman, and he free dove a lot. And he promised Junior, you know, hey, I'll catch you a fish, and when I'm back, we'll cook it and we'll eat it together. But he never returned. So that was devastating. The whole of Rio was devastated. But, you know, the supporters themselves and the team itself was, you know, they felt it the hardest, obviously excluding Coutinho's own family, but it really hit them hard. But they took that energy and unfortunately, you know, took it all out on Liverpool on that Tokyo morning, I suppose.
Oh, you don't have to apologise to me. You can apologise to Stephen. He probably took it far personally than I did. I'm just quite happy that the best team won. Don't worry about that. There's no need to apologise to me at all. I suppose, so, I mean, obviously after the high point then, Lou, of this, you know, this intercontinental victory against Liverpool, you know, and like you say, you make a great point about, you know, how, you know, South American club sides taking on European club sides, and you know, and it's an opportunity to certainly back then to perform at a wide, you know, perform to a wider audience to show what South American football is about. But once you hit this high point of, you know, I suppose being labelled as world champions or the best club side in the world, with regards to this Flamengo side, then what came next? What happened after the Liverpool victory?
So they didn't go on to win more international titles until this most recent side. But in Brazil itself, they won, you know, we spoke about how they hadn't won the title, any national title until 1980. But they managed to do that after the 1980. They went on sort of a streak, if you will, right? Brazil at the time, like we said, the league, the championship was in playoff format. That was an era that there were a lot of good teams in Brazil, and it was hard to maintain that level of success. To that point, in 1981 season, Grêmio was the team that actually won the national championship. But then, you know, people can look at that and say, well, use it against Flamengo to say, well, that 81 side must not have been that great, since, you know, we're picking that year to represent their greatness, but they didn't even win their national league. But the problem is that playoff format doesn't reward consistency, right? So we can look at it a different way. If we take a wide lens and analyze the entire decade, so starting in 1980, there's not a single club in Brazil that appears in a list of champions more than once in that entire decade, except one club, and that's Flamengo, who appears in the list not once, not twice, but four times, right? They managed to win in playoff format the national championship four times in that entire decade. So after 81, just because maybe they didn't, you know, win the Libertadores again, they dominated the Brazilian scene. And funny enough, that actually coincides with Zico's presence at the club as well. He, you know, as we all know, he went to play for Udinese in 1983, and Flamengo didn't win. After 82, Flamengo didn't win a Brazilian championship until 1987, and that was when Zico was back at the club. But, you know, there was tremendous success, just not on on the same scale as winning the Intercontinental Cup. But they were able to carry on that success and maintain and go up until even 1992.
I mean, Stephen, that, you know, that's, I mean, obviously, you know, as a Liverpool fan, it, I suppose it's slightly different. You know, there are, you know, maybe you could include Real Madrid, Barcelona, where you have multiple dynasties or, you know, incredibly prolonged periods of success. But it's so difficult, isn't it, when you reach such highs, or, you know, certainly as Lou's talked about there, and he'll know far better than I do with regards to the, you know, the amount of time and effort it took Flamengo to reach that absolute peak, and to then sustain that becomes really, really difficult, doesn't it?
Well, it does. To get to the top and then sustain where you are is absolutely, you know, the most difficult thing for any successful football club to do. You know, you ride the crest of a wave to get up there, and then once you're up there, there is only one place to go. So to maintain your position at the top is just such a, you know, a massively, massively difficult thing to do. And yeah, you know, gravity eventually takes hold and a team will drop away. Doesn't matter who you are, you cannot sustain, you know, those kind of peaks indefinitely. And football will always be a cyclical, you know, in nature. You know, what comes up will come down, but it doesn't just like yo-yo, it go around in a circle and you'll come back to where you started. You know, and that's just what happened to Flamengo as much as it happened to Liverpool, you know, and every other football club. Manchester United are going through it now. You know, they've been at the top of an arc. Now they're on the way back down again. So, but they'll bob back up again, you know, at some point in the future. It happens to every football club. But it's what makes those peaks so precious. You know, you earn those successes, and then you go round again, and you know the tougher days make the great days all the more, you know, spectacular.
As a part-time Hull City fan, obviously, I'll just have to trust you on all of this, guys.
But even then, I'm a great believer in those peaks that kind of like, you know, the supporters of kind of like the club that are most successful that win those trophies. You know, anyone, you know, you could pick a non-league team. You know, it's the relation of how big the mountain is. You know, so you might be a non-league team that wins an FA trophy, but that FA trophy will feel as real to a supporter of a non-league team that, you know, a European Cup success will do to a Liverpool fan, or, you know, the Copa Libertadores will do to a Flamengo fan. You know what your mountain, the peak of your particular mountain is, and for a Hull City fan, then, you know, surely, you know, gate crashing the Premier League in the way that they did from the depths of despair, you know, you've still got that massive, massive mountain that was climbed to get there. You know, I fully believe that, you know, that shock of exhilaration will. You know, if you could measure that somehow in a football supporter, then every supporter, every football club will have felt that pronounced spike in one way or another.
You're right. You are absolutely right. You know, it's a fair point. Everything is relative, and it's funny because I'm going off track a little. But obviously, you know, North Ferriby United, which is a tiny village side, about 2 or 3 miles from where I live, they did win the FA Trophy and got to the conference. You know, like you say, Hull City gate crashed the Premier League, and it is all relative.
It's absolutely massive. I lived in a little village called Burscoe once upon a time, and they won the FA Trophy. You know, as a kind of second or third tier non-league side, you know, they were one of the smallest outsiders to win it, and that was massive for the village. You know, it absolutely went off that night, and you know, it was amazing to kind of like, you know, witness it happen as an outsider. And I fully believe that, you know, those mountains are completely relative to what the support of a megalithic football club feels when they're bouncing around for winning a European Cup final or a Copa del Libertadores.
We love doing this, and we love doing the my side, and we've already reached the hour, but that's fine. We can still carry on. It's fine. I've no problems there. There's sort of two or three things that I do still want to ask you and touch on about this side. And obviously one of them is, I love to hear about legacy and where, when you talk about sides and where they fit in the history of the game. I love the history of the game. I'm a keen student of the history of the game. And I suppose from your perspective, certainly as a Brazilian, you know, this 1980-81 Flamengo side, you know, where does their legacy sit? What are we looking at nearly, 40 years later?
Funny you ask that. Like I said before, in Brazil, they're known as the greatest club side after that Santos of Pelé, right? But yeah. Whenever, you see on TV, for example, pundits talking about currently great club sides, for example, even back when Pep's Barcelona was all the rage, they did a comparison to this 1981 Flamengo side, a lot of it because of the playing style and of how they won. And it's funny to see these comparisons. They go back, they keep going back to this team. And even now, this last Libertadores winning side, they compared it to this 81 Flamengo side. And, it was a wash for this Flamengo side. Now, I don't know if, again, these pundits have some nostalgia or what it is. I would certainly pick the Flamengo 81 side based on quality of the players alone. So that tells you where these guys stack up in the history, right? That Santos of Pelé, like we said before, was transcendental. And then this team is right behind it. And after that, there's kind of a drop off in everybody else. So when they talk about this side and they bring up Santos and then they bring up the 82 Brazil side, they even, people even bring up the 74 Netherlands side, Brazil 1970. It really tells you where they stack up and how they're viewed from a Brazilian perspective.
Do Brazilian football fans, obviously, supporters of, different teams, right across the country, is there an acceptance that this side is, even though they may not support this side, even though they might be, bitter rivals, but, like you talked about there about transcending the game, do and can Brazilian fans acknowledge the greatness of this Flamengo side?
Yes, they do, which is really, really rare in Brazil. I don't know if people are just being disingenuous or, sometimes it even makes it hard for you to have a good, open and honest conversation about other clubs when someone won't admit other clubs' greatness. I don't know. And Steven said something which kind of sparked a light in my mind. When he was talking about him appreciating other clubs, maybe that has to do with, if your club is quote unquote winner. Well, I guess I was thinking maybe that helps you appreciate other clubs. But, clearly you're a whole city supporter, which, they don't have that winning tradition, but you are able to support other clubs. So I don't know. It's what we call clubism in Brazil. There's this weird clubism where people have a hard time recognizing other clubs' successes. And I say that in a more general way, right? Obviously, yeah. There will be people who can do that. But in general, it's a really weird sort of thing to do. And then that even goes up to the national team, right? When if you have a national team selection, say with a good number of, we'll just pick Flamengo players, like just say four Flamengo players, you will hear other club supporters crying about how their clubs aren't being picked in this and that, instead of just basically, you know, analyzing the form or how these guys are doing. And then that goes within the regions too. If there are too many players that play on Rio-based clubs, then São Paulo supporters will whine and say, oh, you know, they're clearly favoring Rio clubs. And so that generates this sort of negativity. But when, for whatever reason, when it comes to this Flamengo side, they seem to not get caught up in that. They are able to actually truly recognize, for the most part, that, you know, this team is great. I still hear and see comments of people talking about how Zico would only score against regional Rio clubs, and, you know, it's like ridiculous. It's like they don't even look at the fact. It's kind of a weird, you know, type of argument to have when they're just kind of talking out of their backside.
Stephen, it's quite an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, we, you know, getting Manchester United fans and Liverpool fans onto the same podcast, or Tottenham fans and Arsenal fans, and trying to have a balanced conversation. But where do you sit on the points that Lou's made there about, you know, maybe it's, you know, if you're quite secure and comfortable in your own team's success and legacy, is it easier, or do some people just refuse to see it and acknowledge it?
Yeah, they do. It's some people completely refuse to acknowledge it. I mean, you know, no matter what a team will do, you know, if a certain supporter just will not have it, then they just will not have it. You know, you could talk to them until they're blue in the face, but they'll not want to know. But then you have that's the concept, is that you either have, you know, it's that tribalistic nature. Either you lean massively towards your tribalism, or you have that two-sided coin where, yes, you are, you know, massively passionate supporter of your own football club, but you have that comparable kind of embrace for the wider game of football. You know, some people are simply just supporters of their own football club and don't want to know football away from their own football club. You know, and then when it comes to kind of like the successes of, you know, their greatest rivals, then they just clam up about it and refuse to acknowledge it or give any kind of praise to it. And, you know, it's just human nature. You know, eventually, you know, it ultimately comes down to the personality of the individual. You know, it isn't about, you know, the collective of one set of supporters of one specific football club. It is just a certain type of personality trait.
It's, I could, honestly, we could talk all night, guys, on this. you know, obviously, I'm going to have to draw it to a sort of conclusion soon, but I'm going to ask both of you, obviously, for a sort of a standout memory from this particular Flamengo side. Stephen, I know you're, as we've just mentioned there, you're definitely magnanimous enough to be able to do that, so that's fine, I've no worries for you. Obviously, Lou, you've got hundreds to choose from, so you can start thinking now. I'm just going to ask you for one moment, one goal, one whatever it is that just sums up this side for you. But before I do that, I'm interested in what, if you can sum up what it is about this side that makes them your favourite side. I know we've talked about a lot for the last hour and a quarter, but if you could sum up what it is that makes them your side, what would it be?
So what I would say is, and again, I didn't live through it, right?
Yeah.
But so I'll talk about the 82 side. It hurts that they didn't win the World Cup, right?
It's, oh, I know. I know.
You know that.
Yeah, I know that.
There's this weird pain, and every time, I mean, I've seen the highlights countless times when they lose to Italy, and it hurts the same every single time. To me, this Flamengo side was somehow that side, but winning it.
Okay.
That's why I have such a love for them. It's as if we took that 82 side with the great players, a beautiful playing style, but they actually managed to win the World Cup.
I like that. I like that a lot. I should take more notice of that. I should try that as part of my ongoing therapy. Okay, so Stephen, for you then, you know, it's been a wonderful chat as always. But if you had to pick a moment that sums up this side, what would you pick?
It's just got to be Zico's performance, you know, in Tokyo. You know, he didn't get himself on the score sheet, but he dictated absolutely everything that Flamengo did and did well in that match. You know, I can remember watching that game, and I don't know if it was broadcast like across the country, but certainly in the Northwest region, we got either the game live or we got, you know, a extended set of highlights, and I can remember vividly sat with my dad watching the game late at night, which would probably indicate it was highlights rather than live, and just being so enthralled at the performance and this lesson of football that, you know, Liverpool were being given, and everything revolved around Zico.
Lou, for you, you know, sort of final words. I get exactly what Stephen's. I get exactly what he's saying and where he's coming from with that. I've never seen anything like it either. But for you, your standout memory of this side.
So, like you said, there are many, right, and including that Tokyo match, which was just magic from Zico. He's just unbelievable. But I have to say, what stuck in my mind was Zico's free kick against Cobreloa. Just, he does this little, the way he steps up to the ball, there's like a almost like a strut, and it just hits the top corner, and it's something that I try, you know, as a kid, and my dad would tell me, you know, Zico, you know, what he used to do is he used to practice free kicks. He would put a jersey on the top, hang it on the top corner, and they just try to hit it every time. And that inspired me to, you know, to spend countless hours. Obviously, I didn't have a crossbar or anything to hang a jersey up on, but I would, there was a wall that I would draw a little target, you know, even a pretend little jersey. And I would just spend hours trying to just curl it in and even practice his little strut step up to the ball and I mean, obviously, you know, no Zico taking free kicks here, but, you know, it did help a little bit. I wasn't too shabby, but that really stuck with me. And even to this day, like I close my eyes and I can see that free kick going in. It's just magical.
But guys, what a great way to finish. Like I say, I love the emotion, the passion, the, like Steve mentioned there, the almost the change in the voice, changing the octave of the voice. It's been an absolute pleasure, guys. It really has. Lou, it's been wonderful, absolutely wonderful. You must make sure you come back on again on the podcast with us.
It was my absolute pleasure. I'm really thankful to you both for having me on. This was a great experience, and I will be back whenever you want me to.
Brilliant. I'll hold you to that. Stephen, another enjoyable Sunday night.
Oh, fantastic. You know, what is the better to do on Sunday night than talk about such a great football team with such a brilliant guest?
It was wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
It really was.
All that's left for me to do, I guess, is to thank the listeners. Thank Lou, thanks Stephen, and obviously please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.